minutes after 8. We do have a quorum with Representative Ogun, Whitaker, Smalley, and Chair James. First issue up that we have is an appointment for the Human Rights, State Commission for Human Rights. Ms. Lisa Fitzpatrick from Anchorage. Are you on the line, Lisa?
I am.
She said I am.
Oh, I didn't hear her. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'll speak louder.
Sorry that we got messed up last Tuesday.
Oh, that was fine. No problem for me.
Okay. Anyway, would you tell us a little bit about yourself? Tell us why you would like to do this.
Well, I believe that everyone has a duty to fulfill some sort of public service, and I feel like this is within my capabilities. I'm a lawyer, so understanding the statutory scheme is certainly something I'm capable of doing. I've been a hearing officer, and so I'm familiar with the administrative process. And quite frankly, it's just a good time in my life to take on this kind of commitment because I am not on a full-time job right now. I've got children, young children, and I just feel like now is the time I can commit that kind of effort to this undertaking, and I'm comfortable with it. I'm interested in the substantive law, and I think it would be a fine thing to do.
Well, I'm really happy that there are people like you out there that are willing to do this kind of a job. I know that sometimes it can be pretty emotional, but it is pretty cut and dried as to how you go through the process and how the decisions are made. Is there any members of the committee here that would like to ask Lisa any questions? We also have Representative Katula here now. Representative Ogun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is your attitude about affirmative action?
You know, I think the law around affirmative action has gotten quite confusing. To be quite frank, I'm not really up to speed on what the state of the law is, and I mean, as it started, it was a great concept, but beyond that, I mean, I think it's taken so many twists and turns in its evolutionary process that I think it's hard to comment on it at this point in its state because it's become so confused.
Well, maybe I can rephrase the question if I might, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Do you think someone should be treated based on their and hired and treated in their workplace based on their qualifications and their experience or another criteria?
You know, I guess I don't have an opinion other than to say that whatever the state of the current law is with respect to affirmative action, whether there is an affirmative action requirement left is what needs to be done. I don't have a personal opinion on it. I just think that the law needs to be followed.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have any other questions, comments? Representative Katula?
Just briefly, I just wanted to thank Ms. Fitzpatrick as well because I've worked with her directly and she always does a great job. So thank you for replying, Lisa.
Thank you.
Okay, then I appreciate you coming and talking with us today, and I would entertain a motion to move Ms. Fitzpatrick's name onto the full body for approval.
I'll move it. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, then with no objections, then we'll submit your name for confirmation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for coming forward this morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, the next issue that we're going to deal with is House Bill 438, which is PERS benefits for emergency medical techs, and we have a CS before us.
Got a new one on your table this morning.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. You have an at
ease? Yes. We could have an Abby. Tell us who you are and tell us what the changes were made. come back to order now. Tell us who you are and tell us what the changes are in this. Yes.
For the record, my name is Bill Church. I'm the retirement supervisor with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. I've worked with Representative Cott's office, Pat Harmon, and Barbara of your office, Madam Chair. And based on the comments of testimony on Tuesday, there was some concern that there would be groups of people that would be that should be covered under this, that the intent is to cover them, but because of the organization's makeup and title designation, they wouldn't be covered, specifically from the Mat-Su borough, where they were considered a, if I recall correctly, a public safety organization, but yet had no police activities under their organization. So what was done was, let me get the original, was to change the first to change the title to remove in the CS that you have, it takes out employed by the state troopers. Out of the title, and then also takes out on the original line 8 that talks about a EMS, or I should say emergency medical service officer, or an emergency medical technician in a state trooper office or in a police or fire department, out of the CS. So it makes it broad enough to cover these other potential agencies, but yet keeps it focused to these specific job qualifications of only emergency service, emergency medical service officer, or emergency medical technician. The key was to make sure that it only applied to that group, certainly addressing the concerns of Representative Ogun.
And that means that wherever they work,
wherever
if they're medical, emergency medical officer or technician, that they would then qualify for this
yes.
language change.
Yes.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee? Then.
Chair, would you like a motion to adopt the G version?
Yes, I would.
Madam Chair, I would move the adoption for discussion purposes at this point of the G draft of 438 State Affairs.
Okay, is there any objection? Hearing none, then the G version is before us. And now, is there any questions or comments? Seems to me like that satisfies the issue that we had. So, yes, Governor Logan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the work that was done on the bill. I think it makes it a little bit better bill. I guess the only concern that I have is that we've started a trend here, and the song "Oh Christmas Tree" comes to mind. You know, I can think of a lot of different groups that have high stress, that don't attain 30 years of service usually. Legislators come to mind, a whole bunch of other groups. And, you know, I suppose we could just allow all the state employees to retire after 20 years if they want to pick up the cost. I guess I'm not entirely satisfied in my mind that there isn't going to be a long-term cost that maybe isn't reflected in a fiscal note, but as these additional people get into the retirement system at a young age, especially if someone goes to work as an EMT right out of high school or shortly after some technical training at a very young age, you know, you get 38-year-olds that are eligible to retire and drawing on the PERS system, that, and they live, you know, as life expectancy continues to go up, live a long time. That, I haven't heard a discussion on that, and I'd like to hear a discussion on how that affects the PERS system over the long run.
Well, if I might respond to that, Representative Wilkins, from my perspective, is that the retirement system is considered to be appropriate based on certain guidelines as to how many retirees there are, what the lifespan of them is. And I originally had a lot of problem with a 20-year retirement as opposed to a 30-year retirement as being a rational program to have. But that's when I believed that retirement was retirement. And in this day and age, retirement is not retirement. So if you're talking about people going to work in their 20s and retiring in their 50s, that's not necessarily the case. And I would believe that the retirement income that they would be getting on this 20-year plan is not going to keep them for the rest of their life. It's too small of an amount. We don't have any idea what that amount will be. And you know, like I look at myself as having maybe even almost my third or fourth career in my lifetime. I was a parent for a long time. And then I went to work for as an employee in a large corporation, and I had about 10 years there. And then I went to work for myself, and I have a lot of years doing that. And now I'm a legislator. You know, so those are all different actually activities in my life, and I don't plan on quitting very soon. I'm way past retirement age. So I think that what we're coming into in the future is a different lifestyle than we've had. And people are going to be living longer, and they're going to have to be working longer if they're going to be living longer, and they're going to have to keep healthier and all those kinds of things. So I think this is retirement isn't a good term for it anymore as much as it is a savings account. And I think we might want to change that term to some kind of a savings account and not even call it retirement. So anyway, I'm comfortable with this, and I do understand the Christmas tree idea, because as soon as we started talking about people who have stress on the job that want to get out in 20 years instead of 30 years, then everybody comes forward with all their stresses they have on their job. Living is a stress these days. I don't know that anybody has no stress on their job. I think learning to live with stress is what
I'm telling you. It's better than the option, though.
But it's better than the option. That's exactly right. So, you know, I think we have to be flexible. And if there's no direct cost to the state, I think it's the same idea that they can get more money this way probably, or a better system by combining their money in this program as opposed to putting in an IRA or something else, that same amount of money for the same length of time. And this is their option. They don't have to do it if they don't want to or they don't feel it's needed. It's just an option for them to do that. So quite frankly, I'm not afraid of having this option for people. If they were hired with a 30-year retirement and they want to go to a 20 and they want to pay all the costs, I don't have a problem with it. I don't even care how much stress they have. So that's from my perspective. Representative Hudson.
Could I get my question answered, please?
Sure, go ahead, Representative Hogan, and then...
I have one question about what is the effect? I mean, surely when someone retires 10 years earlier, they're going to be drawing on that retirement system. I mean, they don't just get the money that they paid into the retirement system. I mean, other people and the investments and everything else help support that payout. And, I mean... Would you address that, please?
To the Chair, Representative Hogan. As I'm sure you're aware, our system is based on the actuarial principle that a benefit is funded each year. So in other words, each year that you are a legislator or that I'm an employee of the state, money is being set aside, the present value of that money, to pay our benefits down the road when we reach a retirement age. So we're basing on this funding of pre-funding our retirement benefits as opposed to the Social Security model that pays as you go. And as part of that whole funding process, there's really three components: our contributions as employees, the employer contribution, and then the investment earnings on that money. So all of this is part of the process. Each year, our actuarial firm looks at this money that comes in, determines was enough money earned, contributed to fund that year of service. And that's why you may hear from various employers employer rates going up and down some year from year. That's that factor taken into effect in that way. Also, we're always reviewing the actual experience of the fund every 5 years. We look at the 5-year history. And so we're always updating our actuarial assumptions based on real experience. Also, actuarial projections are also adjusted by mortality. You're absolutely correct that mortality is increasing. And we're taking that into consideration as we predict the cost of benefits. Now, relative to this particular bill, yes, it is, it's very expensive. What you have is you have a person going along who is in a 30-year retirement program. At the end of 20 years, they say, I would like to apply all my emergency medical technician time and transfer that over to the 20 and outer peace officer system. Inherently, it's much more expensive to fund a 20 and out benefit. And we will do a calculation at that time of what the difference will be at that point in time for this person to retire based on a 20 and out benefit. So they are going to have to pay the difference in those costs, and they can either pay them up front or they can take a lifetime reduction to pay for those. Now, the, depending on the person's age and what tier they are, these costs may also include the present value of the health insurance that the system required, is required to pay. So we do try to take in the true value of these costs. Also, we build in an anti-selection factor. On the theory that only those that are advantaged will take advantage of the benefit. So this is this principle in the actuarial science of anti-selection, and there is a factor built in for that as well. We try to take in all of these known and unknown factors into the process.
Follow up. So, bottom line, does it cost more to others that are contributing to PERS to have people opt out early?
Chair, Representative Hogan, no, there is no additional cost to either employees or employers for affording an individual this type of an option.
I understand that, but does it cost more to the PERS system? I mean, surely, these people are going to be drawing on that PERS system 10 years longer. So you're telling me that all the costs of drawing 10 years longer are borne by the employer and the employee?
Through the chair, Representative Hogan, those are borne by the employee taking advantage of the program. As an idea, we did a workup on this through our actuary. If someone is a Tier 1 employee and they have 20 years in one of these bills that has been passed it, under this type of scenario, to fund their 20-year benefit, the total cost of that is $282,000. The non-peace officer 20-year retirement liability is $107,700. So they would have to pay, the employee would have to pay the difference of what has been funded versus the money necessary to fund the 20-year peace officer benefit, which is $174,500. That's what that employee would either have to pay up front or take a lifetime reduction to pay for. And this is going, this example was based on someone who had an average salary of $50,000, because each one of these calculations is individual specific based on their age and service accruals and salary, and the average salary for the benefit calculation purpose.
Thank you for the clear explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson?
Yes. Bill, the actuarial value of the PERS program is about 108% at the present time. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Hudson, I believe on the next report it's going to come out and be a little bit higher than that, but that's within the ballpark, yes.
What I was trying to point out, and I think this is for the benefit of Representative Hogan, is that the investments earnings on the monies that have been collected from the employees and the employers through the investment practices that they've had is now greater than what it would take in order to literally pay off every single employee in the state of Alaska, which is really very unusual because, typically speaking, most of these actuarially based retirement funds and programs rest at about the 80% across the nation. So here in Alaska, we've really done quite well. In fact, there's extra money in the program to actually expand benefits or to, you know, for other purposes. But that money belongs to, once it's put in there, belongs to the employees. You're part of that whole thing because they pay a part of this in your behalf. You actually have stock into that PERS program, as does every one of us here.
But that's kind of important, Madam Chair, because when we're talking about what the costs are, there are no costs. But I must say that, and this is on the same subject that you broached, and I differ a little bit with you, because I would not want to see the entire state program rolled over to a 20 and out. I think there's some big disadvantages to having every state employee be able to literally opt out in 20 years. I think there's some value to having 30-year employees, sort of career employees, as opposed to, say, troopers and EMTs and things like that. But in this particular case, where they have similar working conditions and stress relationships, I think that it's probably a reasonable thing to consider, and that's the reason I'm supporting this one.
Well, in response to your comment about career employees, I think you're absolutely right. We need them. But I don't know that because they're retiring can retire at 20 that they do necessarily. If they want to continue to work, they can. I just think that if some people have the option, that everybody should have the option. And I agree, there's a real benefit for long-term employees. And we can make them, we can treat them different in if they stay, I think. The other comment that I wanted to make a few years ago, I recall, we were having a problem, a majority getting our goal of reducing general fund spending, and voila, they decided we could put $16 million less into retirement, and it got us away because of it being over the, because they didn't need so much employer contribution. We reduced the employer contribution because it was going so. I'm a little concerned that 108 or more percentage is not proper. To have it over there. However, I can understand that someplace down the line we not be making so much. And so, and I've been waiting every day for the television to tell me that the day is here when our earning capacity has been exhausted. So based on that, I'm not pushing that envelope either. But under normal circumstances, I would think that if once it gets over 100%, that we ought to reduce employer and employee contributions equally on that. So,
I'd like to respond to that, if I may, because, Madam Chair, at the last board meeting, the employer rates were adjusted down because of the very favorable funding ratio that we're experiencing now. So the employers are receiving, obviously the state included, going to be receiving a benefit, similarly to the one that was a number of years ago that you mentioned, where not only did they adjust downward the employer rate, but they revalued the structure of the system. Essentially, they changed the interest rate assumption at that point in time, and that created a great savings for the state.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. When you were doing these comparisons of a 20 and out and various other time periods, did you take into consideration you're splitting your retirement, you're not taking it all, you're going to split it with your surviving spouse. Did you take those in? I'm older than dirt. My wife may be just out of high school, and I pass on, and so she's going to have a whole lot of money for a whole lot of time, you know, long, well, not from legislator salary, but she'll have a couple of pennies for a long time.
Through the chair, Representative Green, we actually base all of our benefit structure starts from one point, a normal retirement benefit calculation. Every other benefit or option that's available under the retirement system is the actuarial equivalent of that benefit. So when we did our calculation, we just used the normal retirement benefit calculation because it would make no difference whether we were calculating that or an early benefit or one of the survivor options, because they all go back to the actuarial equivalent of that normal benefit.
And on that point, Bill, thank you, Madam Chair. The member who is retiring, because I'm in that category, that chooses to have a widow's benefit or a reduced benefit for your wife if you're deceased, comes out of your retired pay.
True.
Yeah. And so I think that's where, thinking back when I was Commissioner of Administration, when all these questions were really new to me at that time, but that's essentially how they account for those. I don't think we do that in the actuarial of the total fund, do we?
To the chair, Representative Hudson, there isn't a need to, since everything's based from that normal benefit calculation.
And I understand that.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that as far as the normal retiree. My question was that considered in the comparison
well, in the
on a shorter retirement?
It doesn't need
20 years. Doesn't need to be. Thank you.
Hey, is there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for your good explanations. This is a lesson today in retirement benefits. So I'd like to have a motion to move this bill forward now.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hudson.
Committee substitute for House Bill 438, State Affairs G version, with attached fiscal note, zero fiscal note, out of the committee with individual recommendation. I'd ask unanimous consent.
Any objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved. Okay, next issue up is SB 247. Okay. We have the staff for the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Marks, staff to Senator Lehman, sponsor of the legislation. Senator Lehman had another commitment this morning and is unable to be here. He appreciates scheduling the bill so quickly. During the interim, Senator Lehman was contacted by several constituents about the situation of veterans entering nursing homes losing their longevity bonus checks because their stay in the nursing home was to be paid for by veterans' benefits. The crux of the problem is the Division of Longevity Bonuses interpretation of the definition of private sources of funding. Under current law, if an individual enters a nursing home, and the care is paid for out of a person's private sources, that individual doesn't lose his or her longevity bonus check. Veterans benefits were included in the interpretation as a non-private source, as anything that is not paid for directly by the individual is considered a non-private source. SB 247, Senate Bill 247, restores the eligibility of certain veterans who are being cared for in nursing homes to receive longevity bonus payments. Veterans benefits are federal benefits earned by those who have served our country in the armed forces. It is not fair to include veterans benefits in the same category as needs-based state benefits such as Medicaid, the receipt of which disqualifies a nursing home patient from receiving longevity bonus payments. The bill is prospective only. It is not retroactive. Persons who had been disqualified solely because they are paying for nursing care with veterans benefits may reapply beginning July 1st of this year. They would then receive their longevity bonus checks from the time of qualification until such a time as they are disqualified for other reasons. Between legislative audit and the Department of Administration, it is estimated that about 6 veterans will be affected by this bill. There is a fiscal note of $12,000 attached to the bill as the department's best guess of how much this change to the program would cost, but it could be less. Madam Chairman, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them now. Nancy Weller from the Division of Medical Assistance, Jim Cohn from the Division of Alaska Longevity Program are here in the room to answer questions, and also Lottie Shaw from the Office of Veteran Affairs should be on teleconference, and they will be able to answer any technical questions that you may have.
Thank you. Is there anyone has any questions at this time? Representative Hudson?
Trying to understand, is there a correlation between this proposal and, say, the hold harmless proposal that we use?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson.
Just pull up a chair and tell us who you are. You sit beside.
My name is Nancy Waller with the Division of Medical Assistance. The ALB hold harmless is for the Medicaid program when a person becomes ineligible due to receipt.
Too high of an income because
of income
these benefits.
Become financially ineligible. We spend about.
Is this related? I mean, is this similar to that?
No, this has nothing to do actually with the Medicaid program. This would only allow persons whose nursing home benefits are being paid by the VA or a combination of VA and private pay to receive
the permanent fund dividend, or the ALB, the longevity bonus.
On the Medicaid.
Through the chair, as soon as they receive even one penny of other benefits, Medicaid or Medicare, they're no longer eligible for longevity benefits.
Senator
Logan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of wish in packets that we get packets that we would, like if there's references to other statutes, that they'd be included in the packet, because there's some references to, you know, some Title 47 things in Section 2, and kind of inconvenient to grab the book, and there's only one book in the committee, and maybe
well, Representative Belden, didn't you have that packet yesterday?
Yes, we did. But it's also helpful to have it in the committee as well. And so, anyway, could you explain what the Title 47 references are there in Section 2, notwithstanding, like 47, 45010, what those payments are, and 070?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I might, I think that the result of this is that people who were bounced off of it because of having received the veterans benefits would now be able to reapply and get back into the program, if I read it right.
That's what I understand.
Through the Chair, Representative Ogan.
Maybe I could summarize, if you could explain exactly what Section 2 does.
Sure. Section 2, the Chair, Representative Ogan. Section 2 states that a person who reapplies, if they were receiving veterans benefits and then entered a nursing home and were disqualified, the amount of the veterans benefits they're receiving before they were disqualified is the amount that they would be receiving again. As you know, or I'm sure you know, is that longevity bonus program benefits start at $250 and they've been phased down to $100. So we are just trying to reinstate what they were receiving before. Under Section B, a person who applies will be eligible for the amount that person would have received had they qualified when they first applied. So all the applications are in file with Longevity Bonus Department. They keep them, you know, from if they applied before January 1st, 1997, they are on file. And if they immediately entered a nursing home and thus never received even one longevity bonus payment, they will begin receiving the amounts that if they would have received had they been accepted when they initially applied. Hope that answers your question.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Through the Chair, Representative Ogan, I do have a copy of the statute.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, we have, did you say, is anyone else here that just wanted to explain it, or were they here to ask questions, answer questions, the people you referred to that are here in the room?
Madam Chairman, they are here just to answer questions.
Okay, and Laddie Shaw, this says to testify, so we'll see. Laddie, are you on teleconference?
Madam Chair, yes, I am.
Yes, you have some testimony on this, or were you there to answer questions?
I'm here to answer questions and just highlight that the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is in support of this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? I think this bill is pretty straightforward. I think it's a really good. I apologize actually for these people being left out of the loop. I think this is a correction, and I'm hoping that that the damages haven't been too severe. So I'd entertain a motion to move to Representative Whitaker.
Madam Chair, in the spirit of mom apple pie veterans in the Alaskan way, I'd like to move 247, yes, for Senate Bill 247 Finance, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection?
I'm sure I'd just like to also add in the spirit of the flag to that list.
Okay. Then the bill is moved.
Trains.
Okay. Next item up is House Resolution Number 49, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund Income Distribution. Representative Ogan.
Thank you, Madam.
Do you want to sit in front, or you want to sit where you're at?
Do you mind if I sit here?
I don't mind where you sit.
Doesn't show my bald spot as bad. I'm on the camera.
Get used to it. Madam Chair, I object. It does show mine.
Madam Chair, I have a sponsor substitute that, if we could, I'd like to put on the table for discussion. But right now, I'll discuss the House Joint Resolution number 49, and maybe some members have a chance to look at the difference. House Joint Resolution 49 was introduced after the September 14th vote last year, the advisory vote, regarding spending the earnings of the permanent fund and the plan that a bipartisan group of legislators put forth last year, both endorsed by Republicans, Democrats, and the governor. And it was, in my memory of 25 years in the state, I don't recall any vote that was overwhelmingly a negative. There's been a great deal of discussion what no means since then, and a number of plans that have been brought forth, but it came to I came to the conclusion that yes, the earnings of the permanent fund were intended at some point to be a rainy day account for our state, and that's a policy call on whether or not it's raining or simply clouds are gathering in the sky of the legislature. But regardless of how you feel about that particular issue, I believe that the public will not have the confidence in the legislature and not have the trust. Permanent fund dividend program is not going to be adversely affected until we constitutionally protect it. So what this bill simply does, this resolution, is enshrines the existing formula for distributing the permanent fund and inflation proofing into the Constitution. Now, the opponents of the bill and the concept have, I believe, feel that they have a stake driven into the heart of this this issue by saying, well, golly, if we do that, then the permanent fund is going to be taxable. I would suggest, Madam Chair, that if it's not taxable now, it wouldn't be taxable then. So what we did is we came up with a possible solution to that, and that's why I would like to possibly move at this time the sponsor substitute for House Joint Resolution number 49 and put that before us. And what that does, it's exactly the same thing as the original bill, except that part, Section 3 adds the effective date of the permanent fund amendment.
It's a matter of a procedure, Representative Olgan, that a sponsor substitute has to be read across again.
Has to be read across again.
So we would not be able to accept the sponsor substitute today. We can talk, we can use it as an amendment, I suspect, or something else, but we couldn't use it as a sponsor substitute.
Okay, well, I stand corrected. I thought I was pretty good at procedures. I guess I missed that one. So maybe what I would like to do is if you could scratch the title sponsor substitute and maybe accept this as a an amendment to House Joint Resolution number 49.
Well, we can do that. I would, before we do that, I would like to discuss the issues without this, and then as the amendment, we can do this as amendment. I would rather discuss, and I don't, do we have any testimony? We do have one. Take testimony on the original, and then I don't know whether this person that's on teleconference has fax or not. We could fax her this amendment. I don't know if we have other people on teleconference besides this one.
I could fax it to the MIO here.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't know if we have more. Is this the only person we have to testify?
Yes.
Okay. This is really a hot issue.
like many of the issues in state
affairs, well, let me make it my idea about this issue perfectly clear before we go any further, is that I think it's worthwhile to talk about all the different long-term plan changes that we should consider. I believe we ought not to pass anything this year. I disagree somewhat. Well, let me say, on the surface, I would agree with Representative Ogun's concern that the public at this current particular point in time is demanding some, or would demand if we asked them to vote again, to protect the dividend over the long term before we spend 1 cent out of the permanent fund. However, I also believe that we have a huge education process that we need to do. And we are saved by the bell in a little ways by having a high price of oil this year, which is going to extend the value of our constitutional budget reserve for a few more years. So whether we do that this year, next year, or the following year, I think we have time to discuss this with the public. I have been having an intensive discussion with public around the state and also in my district. And the day after, or 2 days after, as soon as I could get it in the paper, I did a little survey in Fairbanks, as an example, to find out what the no vote meant. It was very, very enlightening to me. And, of course, at the top of the list, says they don't trust the legislature. And I agree with that. I don't trust them either. However, I do believe that every legislator is sincere and honest in their ability and desire to do the right thing. But when you take 40 districts who are representing 40 different pieces of people around the state, you get 40 different ideas, and in order to get anything done, you got to come to an agreement. I am here to say that I plan, whatever plan that I would support, that it includes a long-term permanent fund dividend, a healthy long-term permanent fund dividend for the public. I think we need that to protect the fund itself, and I never have any intentions of ever spending 1 cent of the fund. However, we're getting an awful lot of conflict. I'm getting people talking out of both sides of their mouth when they want on more spending done on one hand, and then in the next breath, they want us to not spend any earnings of the fund. And I've said consistently that over the long term, and I don't know what long term means, it may be 5 or 6 years from now when the deadline would be here, that there's no way to balance our budget over the long term and provide the services the public demand without continuing to make efficiencies in government, without having some combination of taxes and using some earnings of the fund. And I use those sums as not any particular amount. And so I think that reacting so quickly to a vote that was so convoluted because the question was so vague and because the advertising on both sides was so intense and misleading in many ways, that we would be absolutely foolish to jump into a conclusion this year. Having said all those kinds of things, I understand the purpose behind this, and I certainly agree that the sponsor substitute, or the one we're talking about, an amendment, does do something to close the door on the opportunity for the Internal Revenue Service to determine that the permanent fund we have is not currently being used for public purpose. And this certainly does allow some room in the Constitution for public purpose. However, it's still very vague, and I'm not sure it would do it, but it moves away in that direction. So having said my piece, I'm interested in hearing everyone else's. I want to hear from the person we have on teleconference. I do not plan to move this bill. Okay? Representative Hudson.
The way I read... And I don't know, can we speak about Representative Ogun's
if no one wants to talk about the bill itself, then we can put the amendment on. We can talk about the amendment.
Well, can we just have the amendment before us for discussion purposes with the sponsor?
Madam Chair, I would move a amendment that would be Section 3 of what I've written as a sponsor substitute to add Section 3 onto... existing bill.
Okay.
Could we accept that as a...
You can object, and then we can talk about it. Okay?
I don't want to object because I want to talk about
what it. Well, you can object and then you can talk about it. Okay?
I'm here.
We'll say that is number one, amendment number one. Does everyone understand that? It is section three in this document that was the sponsor substitute. Is amendment number one. Okay, now you can go ahead and talk about, you got an objection to be able to discuss the amendment.
Okay. The way I read this amended version now is that everything that exists on statute today would be embodied constitutionally when this was adopted by the public. So essentially the formula that predicates the PFD, the permanent fund dividend, which is the earnings of the permanent fund or one half of the earnings reserve account minus the unrealized gains in the permanent fund, whichever is less, would determine the permanent fund dividend.
That's correct.
Now, if we do that, it seems to me like the problem that some of us had with the existing language is now embodied in the Constitution. And the concerns I have is that if we embody this in the Constitution, we are asking the people to vote on essentially, in my opinion, the elimination of the permanent fund dividend, because the income in the earnings reserve account is accessible by 21 votes even now and would be continued to be available. But the dividend, in my opinion, would be gone by the year 2007 at the latest, or maybe at the earliest, but 2010 at the latest. And I guess that's my concern, Representative Ogun, is that what I've tried to recognize all along is that the formula that we have at the present time deals with inflation proofing and deals with the distribution of income for the dividend and speaks absolutely nothing about the balance of it. It leaves it silent, but it leaves it available. And so we would be constitutionally leaving those monies available, and I think that it would lead to the elimination of the permanent, where you would be almost guaranteeing the elimination of the permanent fund dividend, all with the understanding that maybe you were fixing it because you were putting it in the Constitution. Unless you change that formula and do something different with that formula, similar to what we were talking about in 411, I think you are going to fix constitutionally the elimination of the permanent fund dividend by adoption of this this language.
Well, I think that's an assumption, Representative Hudson. Certainly, if we were to not impose any taxes and not cut the budget, you're true. That would be true. I still think we need to look for efficiencies in government. There are a lot of things that we're currently not spending money on that we need to. I'm going to be working on what I call a zero-based budget this year to find out just exactly what I think a reasonable amount for us to be spending would be doing. And so under the assumption that we only spent the rest of the earnings, you're absolutely right, because we could be spending them as they're coming in if we had the appropriations to do that. And so then half of the earnings of the fund would be less than what the dividend calculation, and so it could certainly affect the dividend. But it takes an awful lot of assumptions in there, that you're going to be spending all that money, that there's not going to be any taxes, that there's not going to be any reductions and that sort of thing. So that's one of the problems we have with this whole situation is assumptions. You have to base them on something. So what is your response to that issue, Representative Ogun?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a deep amount of respect for a member from Juneau and his viewpoints. And I, the same argument was made that, boy, if we don't do the last plan, it's going to go away, and the public didn't buy it last time. And I think it's based on a model that is a very pessimistic model of the future of our state and the future of Anwar. And I frankly don't think if those earnings were continue to be redeposited back into the permanent fund, which we haven't done in the last few years, or at least a significant portion of those, and a small portion of the earnings after constitutionally protecting the permanent fund dividend, I would support using some of the earnings. If we knew that the dividend program was off the table, I would support using some of the earnings for some of the things like in some of these other bills that we've had, which I won't discuss because it's probably out of order. But but I think anybody that thinks that we're going to be able to use those earnings without constitutionally protecting themselves is fooling themselves, because I don't think the public will allow it. That's the bottom line here. This is the key, in my opinion, to opening the discussion of what we're going to use the earnings after the dividend program is protected. With all due respect to my good friends in here, I think they're fooling themselves.
Let me put another issue on the table here, and that is the decision as to whether or not to continue to operate, to manage the permanent fund as we do currently, where the accounting procedure is that all earnings of the fund go into the earnings reserve, including unrealized gains, and that the dividend is calculated on a five-year average of the income. That reason for that was that it's assumed that the income will go this way. And so rather than having the current income, which is probably a lot higher than it was 5 years ago, to be the determining factor of what the dividend was calculated on, we bring it down with this average here. My personal belief that it's going to go this way, because I'm just waiting for somebody to tell me that the bubble is broken, on the whole issue, because what I see is a whole different investment concerns on the stock market, where it's not necessarily tied to income and or dividends as the reason why people are willing to pay more for shares. When it starts going this way, then what happens is the high income brings the average of the income this year up, yet you're paying out of this current income stream. So that could be a problem. So the average, calculating anything you use out of the permanent fund, using the overall system as an endowment, and take a percentage that's good over time, certainly does a couple of things. One, it would make the dividend more stable, because I think people do count on the dividend. They know how much it was, and they think it's going to be at least that much and more the next year. So for the dividend, it makes it more stable. But even it does, what it does do is it gives the permanent fund board more flexibility in their investment policies, because they know how much money is going to be drained off. And so one of the things that we've done consistently, and I think we'll probably do again this year, is put some more money back into the permanent fund from the earnings. And one of the advantages of doing that, which makes more earnings, is because they're still investing the entire piece. But by putting it back into the permanent fund, which is protected from ever being spent, it gives the permanent fund people who are managing it more opportunities to make more money with that for longer investments and different kinds of investments. And that's one of the reasons why we've been so successful, is by keeping putting the money back into the fund. So if we can, I'm not convinced at this time that the current system that we have is what we ought to have over the long term. I think we need to spend a lot of time thinking about that. I am convinced, however, we do need to have a healthy dividend over the long term. I don't know what that is, and that's yet to be discussed in the whole concept of everything. So to put everything that's in law today, I think, would be a huge mistake. Second of all, I do have a bill it was only referred to finance, that would inflation-proof first. If we're going to stay on the income to the earnings reserve system, then I think before we calculate anything, we should inflation-proof first. And we've heard that argument say, well, it's inflation-proofed already. It isn't. The way the design and the accounting of our permanent fund dividend is not inflation-proof at all, unless we put inflation-proofing in there. So I think that should be the first thing. And before I would put anything in the Constitution, I would inflation-proof it first. I wouldn't have any problem with making a constitutional amendment to inflation-proof it first before we do any spending whatsoever, because I think that the value of the money is there needs to be protected over the long term. I think that we need to have a fence around our state spending. This is not a part, and that's a part for me, is that how much can you increase the budget each year without having a supermajority vote from someplace to determine whether, you know, so we could cover emergencies and or special projects, but only if we have a supermajority vote. And that only with 21 you can only do something. You can't get it any bigger than this. I think we need to work on the language for that. I think we have, this is not a simple issue. We tried to solve it in one simple way last year. It didn't work. But we did get some ideas out there, and we've got the people tuned in, and now we need to concentrate seriously on coming up with a plan that will work over the long term. So, anyway, having said that, that's some of the other concerns I have with doing this.
May I address?
Yes, go ahead, Captain Olgan.
Madam Chair, I agree with a lot of what you said, especially the fence around spending. That's one of the another piece of the puzzle that is not before us, but it's why I would implore you to move this today. I've heard you say a number of times that you moved things that you didn't support, but you needed to get it to the Finance Committee so they can have those tools to build a solution. And without at least this being moved onto Finance, we're not giving them a full toolbox.
Well, I would tend to agree with you that, but you know, I had a tax bill in this committee. I didn't move that either because I had no intentions of that passing this year. And I moved House Bill 137, which was a municipal dividend, because there's an interest. In fact, there's a Senate bill currently now on that same issue over there, and I moved that because there was a number of folks who thought it might be something they wanted to do, and I moved 411. Not because I liked it, but because I promised some people I would after they twisted my arms. So anyway, that is how that got there. And, you know, I don't think this has any chance. I could put it to Finance, but I won't move anything to Finance without getting permission from the Finance Committee people for the pressure they might get with the bill in their committee. So anyway, having said all that, let's listen to the two people we have on teleconference and see what they have to say. I wanted to have some discussion before I heard from them, mostly because I've talked to at least one of these people, these persons, and I thought that that she might want to hear this before she testified. So let's go ahead and listen to Mary Griswold from Homer.
Thank you. This is Mary Griswold. I am opposed to House Joint Resolution 49. I think it is a poor idea from a policy perspective because it takes away the legislature's authority to appropriate funds. HJR 49 is a poor idea from a financial perspective for all the reasons that changing to a percentage of market value distribution is a better idea. Although there are no performance guarantees with the market value approach, it does remove the dependence on volatile realized earnings and offers a more stable dividend distribution based on the real return of the permanent fund investments. By guaranteeing the dividend in the Constitution, this bill may also trigger a federal income tax assessment on the permanent fund earnings. However, the most important consideration of HJR 49 is a philosophical one, whether decreasing our permanent fund dividend should be an option to help bridge our growing fiscal gap. I support a healthy dividend distribution. I think a long-range financial plan, including better control of government spending and a combination of reasonable taxes, should be developed before the dividend program or the fund's undistributed income is tapped. However, adjusting the dividend should remain a legislative option for balancing personal benefit and common good for all Alaskans, as other general fund revenue sources are depleted. Shortchanging funding for essential public services or raising exorbitant taxes in order to sustain a large personal dividend does not serve our best interests or the purposes for which the permanent fund was established. Many people who support HJR 49 believe it will preserve the value of their dividend. There are no guarantees for a continued high dividend, no matter what formula is applied. Other people want the government to keep its hands off the dividend program, no matter how much essential public services must be cut. I hope that with continued discussion, the public will come to understand the real fiscal picture and agree to a well-reasoned, long-term financial plan that controls spending, taps additional sources of revenue, including a combination of taxes, and then uses permanent fund earnings to balance personal and common good for the benefit of all Alaskans. I think you have your work cut out for you to develop this plan, and sincerely hope you are willing to tackle it soon. Thank you.
Barry, do you have that written that you just testified?
Oh, yes.
Can you send us a copy?
I'd be happy to.
You have our fax number?
Yes.
Okay. Next in Homer is Mary Raymond.
Yes, thank you. Mary has articulated everything so beautifully. I always tend to shorten things up. I am not in favor of HJR 49. I think it would be folly to tie yourself into a section agreement. And I don't think that the people of Alaska really put their permanent fund dividends ahead of services, ahead of the importance and the whole, the benefit and goodness to the state. I think that we are more reasonable than that. And I go back, if we talk about that vote in September, I think one of your colleagues said it best. They're going to say no because they don't trust us. And we didn't understand what this was all about. It was referred to as a plan. There was no plan offered to us. We had no idea of what that meant, just to say, yes, do, whatever. So if you want to listen to your constituents, but believe that your citizens do want to further and better the life of everyone in the state of Alaska, I think you'll do all right.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary. Is there anyone else out there on teleconference that wanted to testify on this? Is anyone here want to testify? We have amendment on the floor before us. Is your objection maintained, Representative Hudson?
No, it is not.
Okay. Then is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, then the amendment passes.
Madam Chair?
Yes. It's up to the committee. If the committee wants to move the bill on to finance, we can do that. Go to judiciary from here, by the way.
Madam Chair,
in
the spirit of letting the committee decide, I would move HJR 49 from this committee, and if it fails, it fails. It passes, it passes. I'd object.
Okay, there's an objection. Does anybody have any comments before we take the vote? If not, then call the roll.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hudson?
No.
Representative Katula?
No.
Representative Wogan?
Yes.
Representative Smalley?
No.
Representative Whitaker?
Yes.
Chair James?
Yes. So the bill moves.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Now we have House Bill 439. Okay. One quick comment before we get completely off of this. On the drafting of this amendment into this one, we didn't amend the title.
The drafter will take care of that if the body of the bill requires it.
Okay, all right, fine, thanks. So we know that. We'll take care of it. Okay, House Bill 439. Who's on first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Allison Elgee, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. House Bill 439 is the statutory amendment to the pay schedule that governs non-covered employees. These are the employees of the court system, the legislature, and the non-covered employees in the executive branch. What House Bill 439 proposes are amendments that correspond to the agreements that we have reached with the groups that we have collectively bargained new contracts that are presently before the legislature for consideration. In fiscal year 2001, that would be this starting this July, we would propose paying all non-covered employees a one-time lump sum payment up to $1,200. That amount is prorated $50 per pay period based on the number of pay periods an individual was employed in the prior year and is payable if the individual is still employed July 1 of 2000. There is a special provision for legislative session employees to recognize the peculiar time frame of that particular employment. And I have actually requested an amendment to the section with the lump sum thing. So I don't know, Barbara, do people have a copy of that? Okay. To clarify the fact that the lump sum payments are intended to be reduced by mandatory employer and employee deductions. So it would clarify that and be in keeping with the provisions that are in our collectively bargained agreements. In years 2 and 3, this would be fiscal year 2002 and fiscal year 2003, we are proposing adjustments to the pay schedule of 2% in 2002 and 3% in 2003. I believe you've also been passed out a sectional analysis, and there is a fiscal note on the bill. I am happy to answer questions that people may have.
Yes, Representative Hudson.
Yesterday, I heard from the co-chairman of Finance, Senate Finance, that one element in the employee pay package that was presented for payment for the legislative consideration, and I'm asking because I'm assuming that whatever we've done pretty much on the collective bargaining side, you're offering for the non-covered employees. And one of the elements that was brought to my attention was that apparently the administration has agreed to pay or permit an employee to sell all of their sick leave, to transfer it over as regular leave and to essentially cash it in, and that some of those cash-ins could be up into the $50,000 bracket. Am I right or wrong on that?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, this, what you are referring to is a provision of the agreement that we bargained with the general government unit. They are the only large employee group still remaining on an annual sick leave accrual instead of a personal leave accrual. And what is included in their collective bargaining agreement is a conversion to a personal leave environment that would provide for a sick leave balance to be converted to personal leave as well at a rate of 50% of what that balance is. In the past, when other employee groups have converted from that sick and annual leave environment, there's also been a conversion of sick leave so that the entire amount of sick leave accrual is not lost to an employee in making that switch. There are a variety of benefits, we believe, to a personal leave accrual environment that, not the least of which is that in terms of the total amount of accrual, it's actually less than what you see in a sick and annual leave accrual. But that is a specific provision in the GGU contract because everybody else is on a personal leave system.
No bearing whatsoever on any of these contracts or on any of these payouts? Would any employee covered by this legislation fall under that provision?
Through the chair, no, Representative Hudson. Non-covered employees have been in a personal leave environment since 1978, and any conversion that occurred back when that statute was amended in 78.
Answered my question.
Yeah.
Okay, so this other issue, which is not in this bill, but since I have your attention, it's if they had X number of days of sick leave and X number of days of personal leave, they would total all those together and put half of them into personal leave, or is it that you take all the sick leave and you take half of your sick leave and put it into personal leave? How does that work?
Madam Chair, at present, the annual leave accrual has a cash value, and the annual leave accrual is not amended. What this proposal does is take the sick leave accrual and amend that piece of it, and proposes just in a conversion environment, converting 50% of that sick leave accrual to a personal leave environment. And then in the future, the accrual rate on an ongoing monthly basis is also amended to reflect that personal leave accrual rate, which represents both annual and sick at that time. It's the employee has the discretion in terms of how they use it.
Okay, but what happens to the other half of sick leave they had accrued?
Madam Chair, the other half of the sick leave is put into basically a catastrophic medical bank. The employee, it is maintained on behalf of the employee. The employee has to be ill for, there's a threshold number of days before they can access that medical leave bank. And if the employee terminates, the medical leave bank goes away and there is no cost to that. It only remains on the books as long as the employee is consistently employed.
Okay, so when am I to understand that the accrued leave out there, how is that funded into it? There's a reserve account, right?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we fund leave on a basically a cash flow basis, not on an accrued liability basis. And we fund it through our working reserve accounts. It's part of the factors to generate those monies are part of your personal services budgeting factors. And there are two accounts. There is a leave cash-in account, and there is a terminal leave account. The leave cash-in account is calculated for each department based on their own historical kind of leave cash-in usage of employees. And that account has funded annually in an amount of about $10 million. The terminal leave account is when an employee actually terminates service, and we pay at that time, whatever is the cash value of their accrued leave that has not been used. And that account is also about $10 million. Those accounts are, as I say, constantly being refilled. It's part of our personal services budgeting factors.
Is it money that's appropriated, or is it just a number?
Madam Chair, it's money that is appropriated as you consider your personal services expenses. It is included in the personal services budget line.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, that's right. Thanks. Well, I didn't mean to deviate from something that's not in this bill, but I had my mind on that. I just wanted to ask those questions. So, Representative Wogan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This covers legislative employees. Does it cover legislators?
Through the chair, as drafted, it does cover legislators, and also it covers the governor and lieutenant governor.
What range are we?
We're range 10A.
Actually, Madam Chair, legislators, I think, are no longer tied to the pay scale. They are addressed separately with a set salary. But this legislation would adjust those salaries in future years.
So a vote for this would be a vote to give ourselves a raise.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it?
At least we've been getting blamed for it for years, you know. Yeah. I guess if you've been blamed for it long enough, maybe you should. Oh. I retract that statement. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What would happen if, in the bargaining process, there comes a problem with funding and that they go back to the drawing board and don't have these pennies in the contracting bargaining units? Would this possibly then say that the non-union people might have a better deal if this passes than the bargain unit had?
Well, Chair, Representative Green, you could end up with that outcome. I would anticipate this to be a part of the larger decision relative to the collective bargaining agreements as those continue to be considered. The reverse has also been true in past years where we have collectively bargained agreements and legislation has not subsequently passed to amend the non-covered pay schedules.
Does that mean yes?
All things are possible, Representative Green. Yes.
Okay.
Excuse me for just a second.
Do you think that there's any possibility that if this is passed, that this would have a tendency to box in the negotiations between the legislature funding and the governor or the administration's acceptance of the increase of the contract bargaining?
Through the chair, I'm not positive I understand your question, Representative Green.
Okay. There is a negotiation that has been ongoing between the 12 bargaining units.
Yes.
Very similar to this.
Yes.
And essentially, there has been some agreement made without the benefit of funding. The legislature is reviewing that as we speak and may not fund it, in which case you have a problem with the bargaining units. Would passing of a bill like this that is essentially the same, in your opinion, have any influence on what happens with those bargained units then? I mean, is this getting the cart before the horse, in other words?
Through the chair, Representative Green, we did not request introduction of this bill until we had agreements with all the collective bargaining units, because we were sensitive to not trying to box them in by suggesting something that, for non-covered employees, that was different than what we were discussing at the table, so which is why you didn't see this bill until lately. But we have now reached agreements with all of those units. Many of them have been ratified. There are a few that are still out for ratification. So I don't think that passage of this legislation would, in essence, box people in. The first-year provision of the lump sum payment that is proposed in this legislation is subject to appropriation. So were the funding decisions may do not include money for any of these agreements, that would not be paid to non-covers either.
Representative,
I believe, Representative Green, that if I heard you right, the governor has signed off on all of the contracts that he's negotiated at the present time. So all of the contracts have been duly negotiated, and the governor has signed, I agree. Now it's up to the legislature to fund or not fund. And those contracts have gone to finance.
Yes, sir.
And because you do not negotiate collectively with the non-covered employees, this is essentially a parity bill to present to the finance committee, just like we did the contracts. So they both would be considered employees, covered and non-covered, and it's still up to the legislature, all of us, to determine whether or not we agree with the increases in the collective bargain and the increases presented in this bill. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative Green.
That's true, Bill, but this is a fiscal non-funding. And as you recall, the governor was instructed not to increase the bargaining units. And that funding has not been approved. So this is kind of, if we approve this, we say, yeah, plus the funding here with a fiscal note. But we haven't said that with the bargaining units. That's kind of getting the cart before the horse.
Okay. I thought perhaps the fiscal notes for the bargaining units were already in finance with the, but I don't know.
They didn't
know.
Come
to
this committee.
No, but they haven't been approved either.
Well, I understand, but
they don't come to the
That's true.
I guess.
We're the first committee of referral on this one before it goes to finance, because this is a policy issue. This is another separating the funding from the policy. My first of all is, how do we get the legislature out of here? Because I'm not passing anything out of this committee that has the legislature getting a raise. So I need to know about that. But I don't have any problem sending this up to the finance. We don't approve the fiscal note, I guess, but we could. In fact, we could send it without one if we wanted to just send it without a fiscal note. But I don't have any problem sending it up there, not knowing what they're going to do or what we're all going to do about all the contracts. But I can tell you that if we do anything with the contracts, I think we should ought to do the same thing with the non-covered. And so, you know, and we're not going to make that decision in this committee.
because that's a finance issue more than it is a policy issue. If the improvement benefits for state workers was just a policy issue and we didn't have to worry about the money, we probably could make those decisions here, but I don't think we can. Representative Whitaker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is a policy issue, but there's a broader policy issue, and that is a balanced budget. We don't have one. Until we come to grips with that, I think it's incredibly disingenuous of us to pass on this bill as a matter of policy.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might clarify, too, on the money issue, we included the cost of implementing this legislation in the budget amendments that were presented to finance in February in order to meet the budget amendment deadline, along with all of the rest of the collectively bargained agreement funding, so that finance was aware at that time of what the complete picture would be. We simply cannot implement, of course, with the non-covered employees without legislation. Also, would you like me to address your legislator question?
Yes.
Okay, Section 1 implements the pay raises for the legislators in years 2 and 3, and Section 8 would need to be amended to strike the word legislators on line 5.
That's a $40 increase.
$40.02.
Okay.
Sure. Can I ask another question? Because
yes,
I have,
go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Allison, I thought I saw something bucking around here that would increase the commissioner's pay appreciably. None of that's contained within this. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Hudson. That is a separate legislative proposal and is not reflected in this bill at all.
Does that come to our committee, Madam Chair? I mean, we're getting policy. So that would be a
which
policy.
Is that?
The commissioners and deputy commissioners and lieutenant governor and the governor. Does the governor involve?
Just commissioners.
Do we have that bill?
I think it is.
I think you're right.
Okay.
Now you know.
Now I know.
We have the bill.
I hadn't seen it. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah.
It would be like we're looking at policy. That's one of them, too. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have...
I'd like
yes.
to move a conceptual amendment that we eliminate legislators from this bill. I don't know exactly how to do it
okay.
technically.
Well, technically it is Section 1. We take out Section 1 of the bill, and on page 4, line 5, we take out the word legislators on line 5.
That's an acceptable...
That would be amendment number 1. Is there any objection?
I'm going to object to it.
Okay. Okay. Then let's talk about it.
Now, that in no way would adversely affect the aides.
No.
As I heard.
No, sir. The legislators are specifically addressed in the section of statute referenced in Section 1. Legislative aides are covered by the pay schedule. Not in a specific.
I'm familiar with now.
Yeah.
I'm just. Is there anything in here that changes that?
That
they would be tied. If we were to strike the legislator's salary, that's all that we would be doing. This bill would continue, and they would be subject to any other grade in the state.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'll speak to my objection. I admit that. Suggesting that I'm worth $40 more a month than the next 2 years or whatever that figure might be is probably up to my constituents. But, you know, I've never been embarrassed to accept the legislative pay that they give me, which is at a range 10. When the lowest paid position in my office is a range 15, I believe it is, and in some cases 19. And for, you know, if I wanted to do it strictly to try to show, I don't know, some ideology, I guess maybe I could go along with it. But I have felt all along that we tied ourselves essentially to certain things that were
not of our making, including the negotiated raises, and so we just kind of follow up along those scales. And I, for one, am willing to stand up and say, I believe I'm worth $40 a month more. And for that reason, I can't support the amendment to take me out of there, and I think if anybody wanted to do that individually, they could gladly transfer that over to my account.
Representative Hudson, I have another bill that we haven't ever even heard, which takes 10% off of our salary. So, I think the salary, and from my perspective, I think the salary is an ability, gives us the ability to have some place to take out our health insurance, and it gives us an opportunity to have a little retirement, and some, those things. But the salary is so small that it's almost non-existent in my life, anyway, as to what it provides. My thing is I don't have any problem as long as I get paid for what it costs me to do the job. And that's why I am so protective of per diem. I could not do this job without per diem. In fact, is the first year that I came down here that it was $100 a day, I almost lost my shirt, and I wondered why in the world I ever took this job. Because it cost me so much more than that $100 a day. And it doesn't cost everybody. Some people are single and can sleep in a room. I'm married and have a family and I have a home to take care of. And I have to pay the bills at home and I have to have somebody take care of it while I'm gone. And I would assume that there's probably more people like me than there are people who can just, pack a bag and come down here for 4 months and stay and maybe don't need that much and don't have a family and don't have those other kinds of things to do. But for me, I could not do this job if the per diem weren't at least at its current rate. And sometimes it doesn't hardly reach from payday to payday. So I could give up my whole check as far as my check is concerned, which is, I believe, and still do this job, but I couldn't do it without being paid for what it cost me to do it. So anyway, for what that's worth, I agree that we are paid what people believe we're worth, and people don't believe we're worth much. And I don't think we're going to change or ought to change our pay until people believe we're worth more than we are, and I think that's our biggest challenge, to convince them that we're worth it. Representative Kula.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and it's really been a learning experience for me, switching from legal profession to serving in the legislature, and it's a choice I wanted to make, but I've called my mother about once a month and said, I don't understand how you did it. I don't know how you moved back and forth and how you ran two households and on so little money. And I'm really torn about this because I think the public perception is that, we're all overpaid and that maybe we don't deserve it. But I think that one of the ways that you fight that perception is that you pay at a decent salary and you make it worthwhile. And you get a lot more diversity in people serving. I mean, young women, young mothers can't afford to take this job. Mary Kapsner barely makes it. I'm amazed she's here. You also attract more professionals. You attract people who could afford then to come over and do this position. And maybe you work all year long. You work longer. You get to work on those interim committees. You get to spend more time doing the things like, I was very fortunate to serve on the BP-ARCO merger committee, but there is some loss in that. So, I'm going to vote with Representative Hudson on this because I think, Betty Fahrenkamp said it pretty well. You pay peanuts, you get monkeys. I think that you deserve to pay for the job.
I like that comment.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Logan.
I can't resist that. Pay peanuts, you get elephants. We have a lot more Republicans than two Democrats. But anyway, Madam Chair, I think that the public perception, it's a small gesture, it's a symbolic gesture, but I think it's that we need to lead by example, and I know I'm still a Republican, although I'm not a member of the Republican majority, but I believe that we're asking people to do more with less money, or on the same money, and state workers, and I think it's disingenuous for us to give ourselves a raise. Now, if we wanted to separate the provision out to where the people voted on whether or not we got a raise, I'd rather they vote on whether or not we got a raise than I vote on whether or not I got a raise. But I think it's an inherent conflict that we suffer. And every year I get beat up for. Yeah, I had this lady call me up. Well, thank you for your vote on your per diem this year because the per diem went down. Well, I didn't vote on my per diem, and I tried to explain that to her. You know, she's probably beat me up or had, you know, feelings about every time we got an automatic raise in the per diem that I voted that. And so there's this perception that we just can vote to line ourselves, line our pockets. And so I think it's appropriate that we just take that out. I don't even want to. It's not worth bleeding for me to get an extra $40 a month. You know, I'll go build some more cabinets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, succinctly, until we as legislators, as a body of the whole, and I know there are many who have stepped forward and said, look, let's deal with our problems and our challenges, specifically regarding the budget. But we as a whole have not done that. And until we do that, we don't deserve an extra $40 a month.
Well, the simple truth is that if we refuse or fail to honor the labor contracts which have been negotiated by the governor and the unions of this state, and the non-covered employees as covered by this bill that the governor sent forward, which is comparable, doesn't cost a dime more for an employee in this bill than it does for the collective bargaining. They're following the same pattern. It's equity. And we are tied to that whole situation. If we turn down the collectively bargained and these statutorily improved salary increases for our public employees, we'll get nothing, and that's as it should be. I'm not suggesting we get something and my constituents get nothing. I don't want anything if my constituents are not, first of all, treated similar to what we agree with all other employees. I think I'm for parity. I'm for treating the employees of the state of Alaska with dignity and with the proper relationship under public employees. And I want not one dime if we do not approve the contracts for all other employees. In fact, Madam Chair, I will vote for your 10% reduction.
Thank you. I have one vote besides myself. Okay, let's vote on this issue. Then let's vote on amendment number one. Are we ready for the vote? Okay, let's take a vote on amendment number one. Before we go any further, we have Jeff Jesse on the line. You just sit there, Allison. I'm sure we're going to ask you more questions, but it's getting close to 10, and I want to be sure that he has a chance to testify. He's the only one that I have. We do have Bill. We have Don, rather, here that wants to testify, so we'll get them as well. And then we may want to discuss this some more. Jeff Jesse, are you there on teleconference?
Yes, Madam Chair.
We have a copy of your amendment that you're suggesting, but go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And the amendment that we have proposed would basically correct an oversight in the drafting of the Mental Health Trust Settlement legislation. And that was there was no explicit direction that the employees of the trust authority office itself would be in the exempt service. The employees of the trust land office within DNR were placed in the exempt service, but again, through an oversight, the Mental Health Trust Authority staff was not. The reason the trustees feel that this is an important issue to them is because we do have a very small staff. We find that having to follow all of the various complex personnel rules has dramatically limited our flexibility. And so we are requesting that this amendment be placed in this bill. We don't have a particular position on the bill itself, but it was the only vehicle that we felt had a title that was